Okay, welcome everyone to this afternoon's Sutta class, and for today we're going to start by having a look at Majjhima Nikaya number 149, the Mahasarayatenika Sutta, the great discourse on the six senses. This discourse, in common with all of the discourses in this chapter, dealing of course with the six senses. And this particular one having only one corresponding sutta in the Chinese, which is of course the Sanyukta Agama 305, in common with some of the others in this chapter, we have relatively few. It would be interesting to count them. Relatively few from this chapter. So after the Vibhanga Vagga, so once we start, another Pindika Vana, so out of these 10, Sanyukta Agama. Sanyukta Agama. Okay, so all of the suttas in this particular chapter have parallels in the Chinese Sanyukta Agama and not in the Majjhima Agama, which is very unusual, probably unique. Could go and check the rest of the Majjhima and see whether that's the case, but I think it's certainly very unusual to find a whole grouping of 10 suttas when none of them have corresponding texts in the Chinese Majjhima Agama. And the fact that they all have corresponding texts in the Chinese Sanyukta Agama, and this of course being a chapter dealing with one of the basic topics of the Sanyukta, the six senses, suggests, or at least suggests to me, that the suttas in this chapter originally belonged in the Sanyukta, in the Salayatana Sanyukta, and were at a later date shifted out of there and shifted into the Majjhima Nikaya. And in the process, since Sanyukta discourses tend to be somewhat shorter, Majjhima discourses tend to be somewhat longer, then in the process one could expect some expansion of the text to end up with fully fledged Sanyukta Majjhima style suttas, as indeed we saw yesterday with the Chachaka Sutta, which seems to have undergone expansion. So for more details on that process, have a look at my History of Mindfulness, and especially the first part of it, where I make a general theory about this as being one of the basic processes underlying the formation of the canons as we have them. Okay, so to the sutta itself. The Mahasalayatamika Sutta, the great sixfold base. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jetta's Grove and Atapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus. Bhante, they replied, the Blessed One said this, because I shall teach you a discourse on the great sixfold base. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Bhante, the bhikkhus replied, the Blessed One said this, because when one does not know and see the eye as it actually is, when one does not know and see forms as they actually are, when one does not know and see eye consciousness as it actually is, when one does not know and see eye contact, as it actually is, the feeling felt as pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that arises with eye contact as condition, then one is inflamed by lust for the eye, for forms, for eye consciousness, for eye contact, for the feeling felt as pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that arises with eye contact as condition. When one abides inflamed by lust, fettered, infatuated, contemplating gratification, then the five aggregates affected by clinging are built up for oneself in the future, And one's craving, which brings renewal of being, is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this and that increases. One's bodily and mental troubles increase, one's bodily and mental torments increase, one's bodily and mental fevers increase, and one experiences bodily and mental suffering. And similarly, for when you do not know and see the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind.
What is a part of the contemplative gratification?
Can I leave that just for 1 second, and I'll go through the positive side of it, and then we'll come back, and because there's a few of the terms there in the Pali I wanted to have a look more closely at. Because when one knows and sees the eyes as it actually is, when one knows and sees forms as they actually are, when one knows and sees eye consciousness as it actually is, when one knows and sees eye contact as it actually is, when one knows and sees as it actually is, the feeling felt as pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that arises with eye contact as condition, then one is not inflamed by lust for the eye, for forms, for eye consciousness, for eye contact, for the feeling felt as pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that arises with eye contact as condition. When one abides uninflamed by lust, unfettered, uninfatuated, contemplating danger, then the five aggregates affected by clinging are diminished for oneself in the future, and one's craving, which brings renewal of being, is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this or that, is abandoned. One's bodily and mental troubles are abandoned, one's bodily and mental torments are abandoned, one's bodily and mental fevers are abandoned, and one experiences bodily and mental pleasure. Okay, so this is a statement on the practice of restraint regarding the six senses, similar in many respects to passages we've met in the previous suttas. And let's just have a look at the specific language that's used here, and we'll see if there's anything interesting to be noted with that. What I'll do is I'll skip over the first part of it, the negative part, and look at the positive presentation. So when one abides knowing and seeing the eye as it actually is, according to Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, and this is something I've mentioned in a number of cases, but it's somewhat difficult to capture the idiom yatha bhutang in a way which is both accurate and idiomatic. As things have come to be, yeah?
Yeah,
I think that's
more,
good.
More close to the Brahma to God.
Yeah, I would agree with that, yeah.
It's past participle.
Yeah, it's a past participle, yatha bhuta, as things have come to be.
Yeah, if things have come to be, it's inner dynamics, you know?
Right.
It's more accurate to the intrinsic.
Right, whereas actually
in
is, exactly, yeah, as it actually is, implies that things are in some fixed way.
Yeah, it becomes static.
Yeah.
But as things come to be, it's in a process.
That's right, yeah.
Also process.
Yeah.
So it captures the meaning of the concept.
Yeah. So as things have come to be. And there are places in the suttas where the Buddha is quite clear about that, that what that means is as things have, through a process of being conditioned, arrived in this state of being, rather than it being some kind of essential state of things. So this is one thing. The phrase yatha bhutan jnanadasana, as is here, there's many, many variants of it in the suttas, but it's a fairly standard phrase in one way or another, knowing and seeing as things have come to be, very often is associated with stream entry. I would be a little bit reluctant to say that it always means stream entry, but it certainly often does. Then we go through the similar sequence that we've made in previous suttas, the eye, chakku, forms, rupa, eye consciousness, chakku vinyana, eye contact, chakku sampasa, and the feeling arisen due to eye contact, chakku sampasa pachaya, upajati vedayitam. Feeling pleasure, painful, neither painful nor pleasant. Okay. So when one sees, knows, and sees these things as they have come to be, one is not attached to, not sarajati, not lustful or passionate about the eye, or any of these other things. When one is not without lust, asanyuttasa, not connected, asanyutta, asammulhasa, when one is unconfused, adinavanupassa, you know, viharati, when one abides contemplating danger or the drawback of things, that means you abide contemplating the impermanent suffering, not self, of something, then the five aggregates, pancha upadana kanda, five grasping aggregates, come to diminution, apachaya. Okay, so this particular word, apachaya, the opposite of it is upachaya, up here, is the building up and the dispersal. These are actually part of the matika of the Dhammasangani, the basic Abhidhamma framework, the Dhammas pertaining to building up of suffering and to dispersing of suffering. And then is craving connected with future rebirth, pono bhavika, nandi raga sahagata, tatra tatra binandini, so together with delight and lust, which delights here and there. So this, of course, being a classic phrase from the second noble truth, then that is abandoned. Sorry?
Born again and again.
Born again and again, yeah. Yeah, this, I mean, and this, of course, is one of the phrases which is usually misunderstood in English, where it's translated in a way that doesn't suggest it has anything to do with rebirth. So many people will read the Four Noble Truths and so on, and they'll say, well, Four Noble Truths don't mention rebirth. Well, of course, they mention
it. What's the usual
translation? It was things like a craving that leads to future becoming, or renewed existence, yeah, these kinds of things. And so they don't really make it as clear as the Pali is very clear. It means rebirth in the future. But the translations don't really capture that most of the time. It's bahiyati. Okay, and then his abandons the bodily darata, bodily distress. Distress, what is Bhikkhu? Troubles, bodily and mental troubles. Bhikkhu Bodhi has it. Bodily and mental distress, trouble. Bodily cetasika, then the bodily fevers or torments, santapa. Bhikkhu Bodhi has fevers. No, sorry, troubles or torments. So Bhikkhu Bodhi has torments for this one. Santapa, torments. And the bodily and mental fevers, parilaha, are abandoned. So he experiences bodily and mental pleasure. So does that answer your question, Honorable?
Yes, it's kind of wondering what the terms are related to, particularly in contemplation.
In which particular section?
In contemplation, meditation, contemplation, danger.
Ah, okay, yeah. Yeah, adinava anupassino viharati. Viharato, I mean, it's the words anupassi, so that's a normal phrase that's used in meditation, like Satipatthana and so on. So, continual watching.
You're like staying off it.
Yeah, that's right, not just glancing at it, but anupassi viharati implies that you keep on watching it, keep on observing it. Okay, so back to the sutta. The view of a person such as this is right view. His intention is right intention, his effort is right effort, his mindfulness is right mindfulness, his concentration is right concentration. Okay, so, but his bodily action, verbal action, and livelihood have already been well purified earlier. Thus, this Noble Eightfold Path comes to fulfillment in him by development. So, by saying that he has the various factors, all the various factors of the Noble Eightfold Path together, does tend to confirm that this person is a stream enterer. However, the footnote here given by Bhikkhu Bodhi says that the eight factors of the path mentioned here seem to pertain to the preliminary or mundane portion of the path. The sub-commentary identifies them with the factors possessed by a person at the highest level of insight development immediately prior to the emergence of the supramundane path. At this stage, only the former five path factors are actively operative. The three factors of the morality group have been purified prior to the undertaking of insight meditation. But when the supramundane path arises, all eight factors occur simultaneously. The three factors of the morality group exercising the function of eradicating the defilements responsible for moral transgression in speech, action, and livelihood. So that's an explanation of this passage according to the commentarial theory. For those of you not familiar with it, the basic idea as outlined in that note there is that the path happens at a particular moment, usually probably assumed while you're sitting in meditation, although there's plenty of examples of people realizing awakening when they're not meditating. But in any case, the basic idea is that at that time, then your mind is concentrated in right concentration, which means samadhi or jhana. Now, if one accepts the commentarial description of this, which I don't, but if one does, then it means that even at that moment, your mind goes into a state of samadhi, even if it might only be for a mind moment. So, you know, all these kind of stories of people getting enlightened when they're washing their feet or turning out the lamp and so on, but they still have that right samadhi, according to this commentarial theory, as a mind moment at that time. And so in that mind moment, you're not actually practicing your sila, your right speech, your right action, or your right livelihood, the three factors of the Eightfold Path. So you're not actually earning a livelihood at that time. So even if you're on Pindabhata when it happens, right? For example, if you're a monastic and you're walking for alms round, But at that moment, again, according to this theory, at that moment your mind is in samadhi and you're not actually walking for Pindabhata at that moment. So those three factors of the path are fulfilled by way of restraint. So you're not committing those transgressions of those things. So this is that it's fulfilled in that sense. But it's also fulfilled at a deeper sense in that the underlying tendencies towards breaking these precepts are being cut off by the path itself. So it's in that sense that that's happening. Now, of course, the problem with that explanation of this particular passage is that it does not say that his concentration is right concentration and that his bodily action, verbal action, and livelihood are purified at that time by the eradication of the defilements. In fact, it says something quite different. It says that the bodily, verbal action, and livelihood have been well purified earlier, which is obviously something quite different. So if we leave aside the Abhidhamma or commentarial way of explaining this and look at explaining it from the sutta point of view, enlightenment and the development, the enlightenment is something generally speaking, according to the suttas, I think it's fair enough to say that enlightenment is something that happens at a moment or at a particular point in time, but the path is something which is developed gradually leading up to that point. And so, according to that model, what this is referring to is that previously, over the past however many hours or days or years or whatever, that you've been purifying your sila. That's what it means when it's referred to purifying bodily action, verbal action, and livelihood. As a result of that, then these things all come together. The other factors of the path, right view, right intention, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi all come together. And these are all kind of developed. And that this is the practice of a person. We're not talking about a mind moment. We're talking about a person who develops all of these things and develops the Eightfold Path, which comes to fulfillment in him by development. In other words, over a period of time, gradually perfecting all of these different aspects. And as I mentioned, does to me, I would read that normally as implying stream entry, but then I would read even the phrases earlier where it says you know and see these things as they've come to be. I think they imply stream entry, but I'm not sure that it's certain at this point. Continue with the passage, then he develops this Noble Eightfold Path, and again developing the Eightfold Path, bhavati, making more of the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path is there and he makes more of it. Four foundations of mindfulness come to be fulfilled in him by development, the four kinds of right kinds of striving, the four right efforts come to fulfillment by development, the four bases for psychic power, the idipadas come to be fulfillment by development, the five faculties, panchindriya, also come to fulfillment by development, the five powers also come to fulfillment by development, and the seven enlightenment factors also come to fulfillment by development. And so, of course, you will all be able to very easily and without any strain know what all of these things are. So the four foundations of mindfulness are... mindfulness of... Okay, so that's right. Body, feelings, citta and mind and dhammas. The four right kinds of striving are...
Is that the four parts of sattva? Four right efforts?
Four right efforts, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the four right efforts are?
Effort to prevent unarisen and unable states of mind. Developing by making efforts, storing up energy and exerting mind, effort to abandon any unwholesomeable states of mind that have already arisen. By making efforts, storing up energy and exerting mind, effort to develop wholesome mental states that have not yet arisen. By making efforts, storing up energy and exerting mind, effort to further develop and perfect wholesome mental states already arisen, not to allow them to disappear, but to bring them to growth, maturity, and full perfection of development. By making efforts,
doing
the energy and exerting mind, and that's why chanting every day is good.
Ah, excellent. Very good, thank you so much, though. Yes, very good. And the next one, someone else.
Chanda.
Four bases of psychic power, idipada. Yeah?
Chanda.
Uh-huh. Which is?
Desire.
Okay, yeah. Good.
Mind.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the last one?
No, actually the second one?
Yeah.
Citta. Oh, sorry, virya, energy.
Energy, that's right.
Yeah, chanda, virya, citta, vimamsa. Okay, the four bases of psychic power. Enthusiasm, energy, awareness, and investigation. The five faculties, panchindriyani. Someone else. You see, the groups get longer as they go on. So the quicker you volunteer, the shorter the group that you get to talk about, okay?
It's very important in meditation.
Yeah, yeah. All of these are very important. Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. Five faculties.
Pasha.
Sadha, virya.
Sati.
Samadhi. Okay, very good. So faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. Excellent. The rest of you are looking more and more desperate. Five powers. What are the five powers? Somebody else. Somebody else. Somebody we haven't heard from before. Five powers. So, talking rabbits. Five powers. So she's trying to cheat. Five powers. Somebody. We're just going to be here. The Buddha should have been so much better organized in there. Okay, the five spiritual powers. Panchabalani. Virya is one of them. Yes. Chanda is not one of them. No. Okay, very good. Five powers. Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. Same as the five spiritual faculties. That was like the easiest one. Alright? That was so easy. So these two are just the same. Next one. Seven enlightenment factors. Satta Bodhanga. Faith isn't in there, no. Yes,
Pasadi,
samadhi, upekkha, yeah? Okay, very good. So, mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, energy, rapture, tranquility, samadhi, and equanimity. Seven awakening factors. So these groups all counted together with the Noble Eightfold Path and all these other ones, total 37 dhammas, and that group of 37 dhammas is known as the 37 Bodhipakkhya dhammas, sometimes translated as the wings to awakening, or the dhammas on the side of awakening, or something like that. So these 37 Bodhipakkhya dhammas are very important, and you should all know them. They are more important than talking rabbits. And
And how useful is it for our practice?
Oh, it's not just a head. I mean, that's just a mnemonic device. I mean, as a mnemonic device, it's how they're recorded as a list of headings of topics. But by knowing them, that means you know when you're learning them, you come to understand the structure and the way that they all interrelate together and all of those kinds of things, so that they then they become a reality when you meditate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, if I learn in Myanmar, usually the two things very frequently stop in the meditation retreat, as meditation introduction. The five faculty and the five power are the same in the factor, but different in the level of practice. The first level we call the five faculty, and the fact when we already mastery of this, So it becomes a high power.
Mm.
It calls it inner power, or it calls it spiritual power.
Mm.
Yeah.
Very
different. Different in
level
of practice.
Mm-hmm.
That's
it. My question is, what's the point of them? Like, because you balance them, you know the list, so you know that you need to balance them. Is that
That's one useful thing about knowing the list. Yeah.
What else?
You can consciously reflect on them. You can see whether to what extent that they're developed in you. You can just find inspiration by reflecting on the list and then seeing them arising inside yourself, and so on and so forth. But I think the main purpose, one of the main things about these lists is that they do give you like an architecture for spiritual development. So because there's a place, and when you understand that well. If you study that well in the suttas, you understand what the role of each of those things has within the overall structure. And then it's very useful to that you can see when the structure's not working, i.e. when your meditation's not going well, then you can see, well, what might there be missing, what needs to be developed, what needs to be corrected, and so on. And then that gives you a framework for looking at that.
I mean, it might be too big of a topic for this moment, but how do you look at all of those, all 30 salmon in a way that, and there's so much of overlap, so for like, how do you see it?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't use it in that way. I wouldn't use it that the 37 of them in that way. I would use each individual group in that way. The 37, as in a sense, is purely a mnemonic convention. When you're practicing, you'd basically, or for me anyway, I would use one or other of those sets, and sometimes it might not make too much difference which one is which. In some cases, you know, that certain ones might seem more relevant, or you might be more interested to develop using that as a framework at any particular time. But you know, it's obviously not talking about distinct things. They're not, you know, it's not you develop one set and then develop another set and so on. They're just different ways of looking at the same thing. So that set, or that way of looking at things, which is most useful for you, which is most relevant or whatever. You can use that for investigation. But also knowing the lot of them, then it also can be helpful, because maybe, you know, you might look at, say, the four kinds of, four idipadas, for example, and you might be working with them, and then it doesn't, for some reason, it's still not developing well and so on. And so then you might think, well, perhaps if you look in the indriyas or the awakening factors, you might say, well, the indriyas actually talk about faith, which is not in the idipadas. So maybe it's that faith which is lacking. So you also use the different groups like that.
I think we can get compared to the life. Sometimes your body is something and then your mind.
Okay.
Can I see the body of the the
inside and serenity of the okay, yeah, I'll come on to that phrase next, yeah. So then it then continues, these two dhammas, serenity and insight, samatha and vipassana, occur in him yoked evenly together. And the phrase here is... tasi me dve dhamma yuganandha vattanti. Samatho cha vipassana cha. Okay. So this idea of the samatha vipassana yugananda, yoke together, literally. Yuga is a yoke. That's what they would tie the oxen together when they're pulling a cart. So the yuga, and of course that's being the root of the word yoga that we have. So when you yoga together, samatha and vipassana, then you end up with a nice dairy product, yes. So this is referring to, in elsewhere in the suttas, it talks about the different modes of practice where you can develop samatha preceding vipassana, or vipassana preceding samatha, and then, or you can develop the two of them yoked together, so evenly and in balance. And so this is an example. This is one of the, this is a fairly rare case in the suttas where it actually talks about this yoking together of samatha and vipassana. In history of mindfulness, I looked at this, and one of the things that was kind of noteworthy was that in the suttas, most of the time, it talks about samatha preceding vipassana, in the sense it's like sila samadhi panya, so your samadhi comes first and the vipassana wisdom develops later. Sometimes it talks about the wisdom first and samadhi later. Where in the modern Theravada, it mostly talks about the wisdom first and samadhi later, whereas in the modern Mahayana, it usually talks about having both of them yoked together. Mahayana, of course, always being liking synthesis and things being interconnected. So that was is the favored course of development, usually according to the Mahayana presentations. He fully understands by direct knowledge those things that should be fully understood by direct knowledge. He abandons by direct knowledge those things that should be abandoned by direct knowledge. He develops by direct knowledge those things that should be developed by direct knowledge. He realizes by direct knowledge those things that should be realized by direct knowledge. Okay, so in this particular passage, although it seems a little bit obscure, it goes on to explain itself a little bit later. But this way of phrasing is directly following on and using the language derived from the Buddha's first discourse, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. So fully understanding is parinyaya, is the first noble truth. Abandoning, pahana, is the second noble truth. Developing, bhavana, is the fourth noble truth, the path. And realizing, satchikaroti, is the third noble truth of nibbana. So let's change the sequence of them for some reason. But the terminology is exactly the same as in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. If you look here, as the terminology, those dhammas which are to be parinyaya, those ones which are pahatabha, those ones which are bhavetabha, and those ones which are satchikatabha, to be witnessed. So, again, coming back to the work I did many years ago on the history of mindfulness, one of the points that I was making was that when the Buddha said that all of his teachings can be included within the Four Noble Truths, just as the footprint of any animal can be included within the footprint of an elephant, so too all of his teachings can be included within the Four Noble Truths. And that Four Noble Truths is presented paradigmatically in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. That's the basic exposition and statement on the Four Noble Truths. But when he said that this isn't merely a general statement of a tendency or a philosophical statement, but it's also very true on a very kind of literal textual level, that the ideas and the concepts which we find in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta are constantly taken up and then explained or repeated or presented in different ways throughout the suttas. And this is one of the main things which gives the suttas such a strong strand of consistency and a strong feeling of a very kind of systematic mind which is guiding the teachings at all these levels. And so even this particular sutta, on the surface of it, quite different from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, but still bringing up various things which are in common with the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. We've already had the mention of the Eightfold Path, for example. We've had the mention of the five aggregates of grasping, the definition of the second noble truth. All of these are phrases which are literally lifted from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and then put here in a somewhat different way. And so this is the kind of thing that we find all constantly throughout the suttas. So here the Buddha goes on to then give an explanation for these things, which is slightly different from the explanations given in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, again showing that these things don't always have to be phrased in exactly the same way, but can have a different approach to them while having a similar meaning in the end. So what are those things to be fully understood by direct knowledge? The answer to that is the five aggregates affected by grasping. That is the material form, rupa, feeling, vedana, perception, sanya, formation, sankhara, consciousness, vinyana. So all of these things that we grasp at are the things that should be fully understood by direct knowledge. Okay, so these are the things that pertain to the first noble truth. So in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha said that the Panchupadana Kandha, the five aggregates, are the, in brief, the exposition of suffering, the what is to be fully understood by direct knowledge. And here we find that these are spelt out. What things should be abandoned by direct knowledge? So again, in the Dhammacakka, then this is Yayang Tamha Pona Bhavika Nandi Raga Sahagatata Paratatara Binandini, that craving which is connected with future existence, which is bound up with delight and lust, and which delights here and there. That is Kama Tamha, Bhava Tamha, Vibhava Tamha, sensual craving, craving for existence and craving for non-existence. That's the definition in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Here's a slightly shorter definition, ignorance and craving for being, bhava tanha, so ignorance and craving for rebirth. These are the things that should be abandoned by direct knowledge. And notice that this particular group is closely connected with dependent origination, of ignorance or avijja being the first point in dependent origination, and craving leading on to bhava being the signifier of the beginning of the returning of the wheel of dependent origination, leading on to rebirth in the future. What things to be developed by direct knowledge? And in the Dhammacakka, this is the Eightfold Path. And again, usually this comes under the Fourth Noble Truth. I'm not sure why this is, the order is swapped here. Developed by direct knowledge is Samatha and Vipassana. So rather than the whole Eightfold Path, it's emphasizing here serenity and insight. Put that in. And what things should be realized by direct knowledge? True knowledge and deliverance. Okay, so there's vijja vimutti, and usually is nibbana is mentioned there. So according to the commentary, true knowledge is the path of arahantship and deliverance is the fruit of arahantship. So vijja in this sense, meaning the ending of suffering and thus being very similar in meaning to nibbana, if not identical. When one knows and sees the ear as it actually is, and the nose, the tongue, the body and the mind and so on, then a similar outcome. And then this is what the Blessed One said, the bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So this is the Mahasalayatanika Sutta.
Do they not just be all of this regarding the eyes, or just regarding the ears, or just regarding some other sensory thing, or is it something you work on for a long, long time regarding all the six senses?
Well, I don't know. I think normally you'd do with all of them. I think it's important, but I think perhaps the case of like when you're actually developing, when that insight arises, it might be just regarding one particular object, you know, at that time of insight. I mean, insight is a very peculiar beast and can happen, can leap upon you unawares at any moment, right? So that's why we have to always be on our guard to keep make sure that we stay ignorant, because if we let our guard down, and we never know when realization is going to pounce upon us, the world could be turned upside down. So yeah, in terms of, but I think normally, if you're talking about normal meditation practice, then yeah, of course, normally you use all of them as, you know, as a meditation. And I think that's important, because it's not just these things, but also the connection between them. And to me, this is one of the most powerful aspects of that, the whole meditation on these six senses, is when you go into it and you look very clearly at what these things are, you know, and you spend time, it's like what I was talking about in the class yesterday, that you spend time seeing the thing as it is. And notice that here we have a very similar kind of pattern. You're starting out, we see the eye as it is, you see the forms. And then you see the connections between them and the relationships. But to spend time in those early stages to see what actually those things are. What's the actual individual thing? What is sights like? And you just spend time getting to know what that visual field is like. What is actually like? What is the object like? What is the eye? And the more you see those things clearly and distinctly, then the more you begin to realize how bizarre it is that our world is made up of all of these different kinds of things, which are completely different. They're completely different kinds of things. And that's, to me, that's one of the most sort of striking things in meditation, is you realize this world, which we think is so substantial, is just made up of all these kind of bizarre connections which we make in our head. You know, we look at somebody and we see this kind of movement of light, which we interpret as being their lips moving, and then we hear a sound and we interpret that as their voice, and we sort of put that together in our head and say that person is talking. But they're really completely different kinds of things that are going on at that time. So the world becomes very strange. And you start to believe in talking rabbits.
But here is like your Dhamma should be developed, it doesn't mention the level at some part, but instead it mentions Samatha and Vipassana.
Samatha and Vipassana, yeah.
Do you think that only Samatha and Vipassana can substitute it for the level at some part?
I don't really think that's what it's meaning to say here.
Yeah.
But remember.
It seems like that.
Not really, because it says earlier, it says that that it says earlier that you've already fulfilled the Noble Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
Yeah? And especially it's talking about that it says that the three sila sections have been well purified earlier. So it does seem as if it's talking about like at a stage of advanced meditation when you've already had direct insight into the six senses and those kinds of things. You've already developed the Eightfold Path and is now talking about developing at a higher level, and at that higher level, for the further development from, I would say, from stream entry onto the higher paths, then development of Samatha and Vipassana is really the critical thing.
So it is a higher stage?
I think so, yeah.
In the practice?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it also saying the sutra which strongly suggests the essentialness of a virtue, and that to actually get good meditation?
Sure.
Insights.
Yeah, well, because it says that those things have been purified earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting in that while the sutra itself deals very directly with vipassana, then, you know, these other things, the samatha side of things, the sila side and so on, are mentioned. You know, it's always that context is always borne in mind, that these things are always part of it. Okay, let's have a look at the comparative study, just to come back to here. So here's the comparative as mentioned on Sutta Central. However, Venerable Anālaya in his essay notes that there is a discourse quotation also in Shamatha Deva's Abhidharma Kaushupaika Nama Tika, which is excellent, because I get to say that again. That the quoted in length there, also quoted in, briefly referred to in the Abhidharma Kosha itself. So, and the Abhidharma Kosha Upayaka Nama Tika, of course, being in Tibetan translation. The Mahasalayatana Dika Sutta and its parallels offer a closely similar exposition on the six sense spheres, which highlights how lack of proper vision and knowledge in regard to the six senses, objects, consciousness, contact, and the three kinds of feeling leads to the arising of lust, and therewith to the continuation of the five aggregates, to future rebirth, and to bodily and mental affliction. Venerable Anālaya has an awesomely epic footnote on that particular point, which takes up basically a whole page filled with references to the Chinese canon. And on that footnote, he notes that the Chinese version Samyukta Agama 305 differs from the standard sequence of enumerating the three kinds of feeling, as it begins with painful feeling, and then pleasant, and then neither painful nor pleasant. And that same sequence can be found in several other discourses in the Samyukta Agama, and another of them lists them all. Many other discourses in the Samyukta Agama, however, have the same sequences found in the Pali discourses and elsewhere. Some discourses in the Samyukta have both patterns, so they start with both pain in one place and pleasure in another place. It's noteworthy that within a single discourse collection, variations should occur in the case of such an elementary aspect of the teachings as the three kinds of feeling, since from the perspective of the dynamics of transmission, it would be natural for the reciters to adopt the same sequence throughout, and it's difficult to conceive of a cogent reason why they should have adopted different sequences. So that's a very noteworthy point. I mean, we're used to the idea that within the suttas, you know, these basic teachers are presented very consistently. That's certainly the case within the Pali. Now, occasionally we find variations. In this particular sutta, as I've noted, we seem to find the Four Noble Truths presented in a slightly different sequence. And I'm not sure whether there's a reason for that, or whether that's just a textual, an issue with the transmission. Of course, in ordinary language, things don't tend to be quite so consistent, do they? Yeah? So in ordinary language, we tend to vary things up a bit when we're talking. So we might talk about pleasure and pain in one case and pain and pleasure in another case. We don't mean anything different by that. It's just the kind of the random things in conversation. But in an oral tradition like the suttas, the accuracy and the precision of memorizing things is very greatly enhanced by having these kind of standard patterns where it's the same presentation every time. Yeah? And so that's something which would have both been part of the Buddha's style of teaching, that he would have taught in that way in order that people can memorize, and also that tendency would have then been continued and increased as the redaction process went on and things became standardized in memory. So this is why we have that very strong tendency to standardize all these things, and it being quite unusual to find a version which is different. And Ahlia goes on, "This is, however, not the only instance of such unexpected variations in the Samyukta Agama. Another example of a similar type is when the name Kondanya is rendered in two different ways within the same discourse. Another case presents a stanza, gives an explanation for the stanza, and then concludes by repeating the stanza that has just been explained. However, the repetition differs considerably from the earlier stanza." And another gives the differences in the Chinese there. "These instances might be examples of a tendency described by Zurcha in 1991, where in early translations there is a strong tendency to avoid the monotonous effect of verbatim repetition by introducing a certain amount of diversification and irregularity, as a result of which in the same translated scripture we often find various alternative forms and longer or shorter versions of the same cliché. Relevant to the same topic would also be one of the maxims set up for correct translation attributed to Dao An, which emphasizes for the early Chinese translators apparently not self-evident importance of respecting the repetitive nature of the Indian texts." Okay, so this is the question is that there are these deviations, and then the question arises, how do these deviations come to be? They might be in the original text, and obviously nothing is ever perfect, so you obviously find some degree of variation within the original text. But generally we'd assume that there's not going to be much, and as in this case, when we do have the Sanskrit original of these passages, the Sanskrit does in fact conform to the expected sequence. Okay, so it seems more likely that the variations are introduced in the Chinese translation. Then the question becomes, are they introduced in the Chinese translation because of an accident? Very understandable. You're translating a lot of texts. You can't remember exactly the way that you did something earlier. It's nearly 5 o'clock. You're going to knock off from work. And you don't have a spell checker. And so on and so forth. So, yeah, mistakes creep through. So that's one possibility. Or the other possibility that Analia mentions there is that it could be a deliberate stylistic point that you deliberately avoid repetition because it sounds too stilted and repetitious. And of course, this is quite normal in written literature, and it's definitely a stylistic point if you're writing in English, that of course you try to avoid that kind of repetition, right? It sounds kind of wrong if you're repeating even one phrase from one sentence to the next. I mean, it's something I do all the time if I'm proofreading, and you notice you've used a particular phrase in one sentence and then the same phrase in the next sentence. You immediately go and change one of them because it sounds kind of wrong, unless you've done it for some specific purpose. So the suggestion here is that that was also a stylistic consideration for the Chinese translators. Hence, when they came to write, the Chinese scholar Dao An came to write a handbook or a guideline for doing the translators. He had to emphasize the fact that the Indian texts are repetitious and that the translations should respect those repetitions. Okay, in the same way that when we translate the Indian text, the Pali text, into English, the translators will have to make exactly the same kinds of decisions, right? And if they want to translate something which is going to be more ordinary idiomatic English, right, then they would often eliminate many of the repetitions, vary the phrasing of things, and so on and so forth. Whereas if they want to say something which is more specific and precise in rendering the Indic text, then they'll preserve those things. And of course, any translator is making those decisions with every sentence that you're having to translate. You have to make those kinds of decisions. Dao An. I'm not sure of the exact details, but they did have quite a sophisticated guidelines for doing translations into Chinese. So Dao An was a Buddhist monk in 312 to 335, so that's exactly the period that the Agamas were being translated. He was a Buddhist monk of the Eastern Jin Dynasty, originating from what is now Hebei province. Mainly important today as a translator of Buddhist scripture, he was active in Xianyang until the former Qin ruler Fujian captured the city in 379, had Dao An brought to live in Chang'an. He spent the last years of his life translating and interpreting scripture as well as compiling a catalogue of scriptures. Okay, so already by that time they were making catalogues and translation guides. Yeah? And that's already quite an early period, 300 and something. He also advocated monks and nuns taking Shu as the surname from the Chinese for Sakyamuni. Okay, so this is something, of course, you still find today, that they will call themselves Shu. Yeah. And in Vietnamese translation, of course, is Tik. Mm-hmm. Tik is the Vietnamese for Sakya. Yeah.
Dao An.
I am not 100% sure. Maybe this will give us some more. This is the digital dictionary of Buddhism, and this is an excellent resource for the web. If you need anything, this is a semi open source database which is by Charles Muller, who sort of updates it all, and then what he does is you can get a certain amount of free uses out of it. And after a certain point, if you want more uses, you either have to pay for it or you have to contribute to some of his entries. Right? So it's actually quite good. If you want free access, you have to actually give him some information. So it's used mostly by scholars and so on. And if you want complete access to it, you have to write him a few entries for his dictionary and then he'll let you use it. So it's quite clever. So here's some more details. A child prodigy is on Dao An, had said to have more than 500 disciples. an earlier developer of precepts in East Asia and a prolific author and commentator. A child prodigy in terms of Buddhist studies, he began at an early age to write commentaries on the Dhyana Sutras that had been translated by Amshagao, a work which, Amshagao being the earliest translator into Chinese, a work which brought him early admiration and numerous disciples. In his commentarial work, Da'an was one of the first to acknowledge the need to break dependence on the translation method of matching the meanings of Buddhist philosophical concepts with pre-existent Taoist terms, desiring instead the establishment of an independent Buddhist system of terminology. He was deeply concerned about establishing standards of quality for Chinese translations of Indian works, and in line with this aim, created one of the earliest catalogues of Chinese Buddhist scriptures called the Zhongli Zhongjing Mulu, known popularly as the Anlu, An's catalog. So there's a series of catalogs of Buddhist scriptures which are included in the Taisho canon. Da'an is also credited as being a founder of the Maitreya worship cult, although through his custom of gathering with his students before an image of Maitreya and praying for rebirth in Tushita heaven. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so that's Anshigar from Parthia. Northeast Iran. Third century. So Anshigao would have looked something like that. Except without the hair.
Maybe he was wearing a
mark. Yeah, so it's Northeast Iran. Okay, so where are we now? Oh, yes, we were on this footnote of an earlier. Okay, so yes, so the conclusion seems to be that those variations are perhaps more likely to have been sort of deliberate stylistic choices rather than just mistakes by the translators. We can't rule out mistakes, but it seems more likely that that's the case. Back to the sutra itself, the Chinese and Tibetan versions additionally point out that in this way birth, old age, disease and death arise as well as the whole mass of dukkha. Referring to the section of the sutta where it talks about the arising of the this when one becomes inflamed by lust and so on, then the five aggregates affected by clinging are built up for oneself in the future, and the craving increases when bodily and mental afflictions increase and so on. So the Chinese Tibetan versions also add to that the birth, old age, disease and death arise and the whole mass of dukkha. Of course being a stock phrase. The three versions continue by applying the same treatment to the contemporary case when vision and knowledge are present, whereby the arising of lust and all its detrimental repercussions can be avoided. The Mahasalayatanaka Sutta, the Pali and its parallels, continue in similar ways by showing how one with such knowledge and vision is endowed with the following path factors: right view, right intention, right effort, right mindfulness and right samadhi, and that the other three path factors should be understood to have been developed earlier. This is slightly different in the Abhidharma Kosha Panika Namatika, as it includes right speech among the factors that are developed by knowledge and vision, so that only right action and right livelihood have been developed earlier. I would suggest most likely just a mistake in that tradition. And again, there's a slight difference in sequence. the Sangyukta has right speech, right action, right livelihood, which of course is the normal sequence in the Eightfold Path, whereas the Sutta here has bodily action, verbal action, and livelihood. I was going to say lively action, but no, it's livelihood. Okay. And then practicing in this way leads to then the 37 Bodhipakhiya Dhammas, as we've already seen, and the Pali and Tibetan versions, but not the Chinese version, also add the statement about the arising of Samatha and Vipassana. The Sutta Pali and all its parallels continue by examining four aspects of insight, though they differ in the sequence of the presentation. The sequence adopted in the Chinese and Tibetan versions conforms to the pattern set by the standard formulation of the Four Noble Truths. So, as I noted before, the Pali, for some reason, has changed the sequence so that it goes full understanding, abandoning, development, and then realization, whereas one would expect to have, as the Chinese and Tibetan versions have, full understanding, abandoning, realization, and then development. The Pali Discourse explains that the five aggregates affected by grasping are to be fully understood, whereas according to the Chinese and Tibetan presentation, name and form should be fully understood. Interesting variation there. So where the Pali down here says that these things should be fully understood by direct knowledge and under the First Noble Truth, the Chinese and Tibetan versions say Nama Rupa rather than the five aggregates. The three versions agree that ignorance and craving for becoming need to be abandoned, while knowledge and liberation need to be realized, and according to the Pali and Tibetan versions, tranquility and insight should be developed, whereas the Sangyukta Agama version only takes insight into account. Again, an interesting variation. But it does rather look as if you look at this list, most of the ones here, they have like two things, don't they? What's to be abandoned is two things, ignorance and bhava-tanha. What's to be developed, serenity and insight. What's to be realized, vijja vimutti. So it does rather seem as if you've got a pattern of these, you know, it's being phrased in terms of these two things to be done. And one might expect to find a grouping of two things in this first one, and nama rupa would be one of those two things which might be a candidate for that. So, yeah. Anyway.
In the Chinese version,
In the Tibetan version and the Pali, it mentions Samatha and Vipassana, okay. But in the Chinese version, it only says Vipassana.
Only says Vipassana.
Only says Vipassana, yeah. Analio does note next to that that the Chinese phrase might be an error. There's a very similar, if there was a substitution of a very similar looking character, then it would in fact say Samatha and Vipassana. So it could be just a copyist's error in that case in the Chinese translation. Yeah.
Because before he
came
to China, he went in Vietnam, uh-huh. And he translated into Vietnamese
first,
and after that he
came
to China. So
who was this, sorry? Anshagal?
Yeah.
Oh, he was in Vietnam first, was he?
Yeah, he was in Vietnam for more than 10 years.
Okay.
He went to China.
Uh-huh.
So, I think... Yeah, it's just quite earlier phase of the
translation. Yes.
Earlier phase of translation.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Chinese and Vietnamese.
Yeah.
So it should be quite identical.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that he had translated into Vietnamese as well. So are those ones that he's translated into Vietnamese, are they now included in the Taisho canon in Chinese, or are they just preserved in Vietnam, or where are they preserved? And are they part of the Chinese canon or not, or only found in Vietnam? It's been included later into the Chinese canon. Right, okay.
Because your Vietnamese language is like Pali, it doesn't write in character.
Okay.
So it has to adopt the Chinese character.
Right.
So now it is a part in the Chinese
Okay, okay, there you go, I didn't know that. Okay, so the Chinese and Tibetan discourses conclude that a monk who's accomplished these four aspects of penetrative insight can be reckoned as having eradicated craving and gone beyond dukkha. So, once more, with this only minor differences between the different versions of that particular sutta. Okay, so the next sutta is quite a short one, so how about we continue with that?